Afro faithful, sorry. I'm right there with you. That sucked. The way that game ended, it sucked. I mean, it didn't feel like it was our game in the first quarter as they were exceptionally hot from three. Then, in the third quarter, we miraculously held them to just 22 points. However, we only scored 18 of our own. The fourth quarter, though, went our way. And after ripping back the lead, late in the game, we found ourselves up by four and through what can only be generously described as an unfortunate series of mistakes and good shooting by the Miami Heat, we found ourselves on the wrong end of the final score. Dropping a game to the Miami Heat on the same night where Milwaukee dropped a game to Boston by an equal 3 points. So we did not gain ground, but silver lining, they did in fact lose without Giannis. If they had managed to steal that game without Giannis in Boston, that would have been upsetting, to say the least. Now, Minneapolis, where we will go to take on the Minnesota Timberwolves before heading to Miami. In this four-game set, I think you have to feel okay if we come away with a split. And by a four-game set, I mean Pacers Heat, Timberwolves Heat. We got the Pacers. Marcus Morris was huge in that game. We'll get to him in a moment. But let's start with this Heat game. What are my takeaways? Well, I want to begin with turnovers. Specifically, I think we have to start with turnovers by Caris LeVert. Now, they're not all on him, but it's certainly a troubling sign where in a first half, where the Cavaliers were essentially neck and neck with the Heat, Caris himself had more turnovers than their entire team. Four first half turnovers for Caris. The biggest turnover, perhaps, though, is while he did clean it up, and while Darius played a very safe game, only one turnover on the game, the fourth quarter turnover that Caris got came in a shot clock violation. And that play, more than any other play down the stretch, is the one that I would pin this loss on, because it was avoidable. It was the situation where Isaac Okoro had a lane to drive if he wanted, but instead, he pulled it back. He waited till Caris came up to the top of the circle to get it. And after receiving the ball with over 10 seconds left on the shot clock, he dribbled around waiting for Jared Allen to set a high screen until there was four and a half seconds left. And then he tried to split two defenders and kick the ball out for a three-point look. It was a shot clock violation, and the Cavaliers gave the Heat the ball back. And then Jimmy Butler proceeded to score on Caris LeVert. Now, I don't put that one on Caris. I actually thought it was a pretty solid defensive effort. He knocked the ball loose. Jimmy gathered and hit a turnaround jumper from the right baseline. It was a good shot. It wasn't that that bucket doomed us. It was just in 60 seconds, you turned a four-point lead into a 6-0 Heat run in which you gave up a foul on a made three-pointer, and then you had a shot clock violation. Credit Rozier. Okoro contested about as well as you could, but for your best defender to have two daggers hit on him in the last 90 seconds, I mean, part of you wants to tip your hat, but part of you also wants to say, we still probably survive that if we just run a play with a minute left instead of burning a possession with a shot clock violation. Look at the structure of that play. So that's the other thing I'll say. Allen was setting the screen for LeVert to be able to come over the screen heading left. But also on the left side of the floor was Darius Garland camped out in the left elbow and George Niang camped out in the left corner, well, mid-corner. It was too many guys crowded into one area. He couldn't split the defenders until it was too late and there was no time left. It's easy to second-guess this in hindsight, but in that scenario where you come up to take the ball from Isaac Okoro, you have to operate more like Merrill does, where you get it in motion and you keep the ball on the floor, not resetting with less than 10 seconds left on the shot clock and waiting for your big to run up outside the three-point circle to set a screen. It was frustrating. But I need to get off of that. In the end, though, to take a 25-20 game from Jared Allen, you realize, now that's the fifth time he's done it, third time for the Cavaliers. He's never lost until now. He does not lose games where he plays that well. And tonight he probably wouldn't have if it weren't for Terry Rozier, who continues to just pile up stats against the Cavaliers. JB, it was a very short post-game press conference. He did address the end of the game.
4-point lead with a minute to go. You know, you got your best defender, one there guy. I take that matchup every time. I believe in Isaac Okoro. He'll take that matchup every time. Tonight, Terry just made the shot.
Now, since Rozier left Boston, he has faced the Cavaliers 13 times. In those 13 games, he's averaging 26 points, 5 assists, and 4 rebounds. He's hit 5 or more three-pointers in nearly half of those games, 6 of the 13 games, including a 10 three-point game back in 2020. You remember that? That was the 42-point game. I am sick of this man coming back to Ohio. I don't care if he has roots here. Somebody needs to Roman Polanski this guy. There has to be some sort of false accusation we could make that could prevent him from crossing state lines. Listen, if Canada can do it with Miles Bridges, I feel assaulted by Terry Rozier and his 5 3-pointers and string of 20-point games. I feel unsafe. Why do we have to let him in? Let's talk about some Cavs, though. Jared Allen, absolutely unbelievable. Just dominated on the glass on a night where Bam was not in, so I did expect him to cook, and he certainly did. He lived up to expectations. But I also think it's worth pointing out that George Niang and Marcus Morris, over these last two games, have given us some good basketball. Niang was very solid in the first half, very bad in the third quarter, and then turned it around in the fourth quarter tonight. And Morris, while a muted night tonight, talk about a debut. I need to speak about him. Because anyone who has listened to the FroPod for any amount of time knows I hate his guts. And I said the moment that Pat Beverly tweet hit saying he was going to sign with us that I hoped he would be anchored to the bench in a cheerleading role only to exist for emergency fouls, similar to the Kendrick Perkins role back during the LeBron years where he was past his productive years as a player, but we rolled him out for violence and stupid non-basketball plays and expendable fouls and hard screens. Like, I would have been fine with that. And then he comes out of the gate and he just makes me look like a total asshole by hitting 4 threes in his first game. And he certainly, at least during this stretch before we're at full health, I can't predict what's going to happen when Dean comes back. But I do think it's very encouraging to see a guy who's had such a long layoff after that trade from Philly and working through the buyout with San Antonio to come in and fire with no discretion and to convert at the rate that he's hitting. But bigger than that, tonight, one of the positives of tonight was, yes, he hit 1 3-pointer from the right elbow, but there was another play in the game. It was one of his assists he got in the first half to Sam Merrill, where Miami was scrambling to recover on rotations as we swung the ball around the perimeter. And Marcus Morris had a shot he could have taken, but as they rushed to try to close out with him, he identified that it was going to leave Sam open. This is a guy who he's played less than 2 full games with, and he recognized he's the dude who you want to be taking 3-point looks, and he moved the ball to him, and Sam converted it. To his credit, I was extremely heartened by that because I've always kind of worried Morris is one of those, you know, dribble into bad mid-range looks because he has a little more in his bag. Sometimes he forces it outside of the flow of the offense, and time will tell if there's any of that here. But so far, based on the first 2 games, I think it's been an encouraging return. Now, it is interesting he's on a 10-day contract. I think most of us were probably a little taken aback. I would have thought that he had the leverage to be able to get signed instantly on a full season deal. I do like, kind of, that he's on a 10-day contract, though, because to me, I said this on Twitter at Fear the FroPod, but I feel like it indicates one of two things. Either the Cavaliers wanted to see if he could fit in this locker room before they committed for the whole season, which would be plausible given their talk of chemistry and how good a guy everyone is and how important that is to them. Or alternatively, Marcus Morris wanted to see that he did in fact have a role before he committed. Maybe he's trying to figure out his options. Now, based on this first game and just based on the usage we're giving him, I would expect he does end up here the rest of the season. But I have to admit, I've been pleased with what he's done. I do want to speak, though, to this idea that somehow his presence adds toughness to the roster through veteran leadership. I don't really buy that. I don't think toughness is a teachable trait. I think he can have it. I think he can apply it on the court. I think there are moments where if we want somebody to send a message or commit a hard foul or stand up for someone, he can do those things. But I don't think that type of thing spreads. It's not some communicable disease that all of a sudden everybody else will start spreading violence. Now, I know Darius Garland got a tech for yelling at the refs. That's very out of character for him. But I believe that was an anomaly. And I don't think people out holding out hope that because Marcus Morris is an asshole, that that's going to rub off on the team. I'll believe it when I see it. But this is just me trying to claim some moral victory because I hate the guy's guts. And I was not in favor of allowing him to latch on to something that I love. It's time for the audio mailbag, which this week takes us to the Pacific Northwest.
Please leave a message.
And now a message recorded and submitted to me at CavsPod.com.
Bob Schmidt, what's up? It's Brett Clapper here out in Seattle.
Brett, thank you for participating in the audio mailbag. What is it that you had to contribute?
I got an issue with this team, or I'm struggling with this team right now. Obviously, we're very injured, but post All-Star break, it's been difficult to watch. Got a couple of good wins in there, but I don't know. I'm struggling because when I think about this team, I feel like our peak was obviously the January run, where we were missing some key guys. And I want to believe that we just got to get healthy, and that's all that's holding us back. We just got to get healthy before the playoffs. But I'm a little bit concerned because I'm just not buying the full strength squad. I can't even remember what the identity of that team looks like. So I wanted to ask you is, you know, what is the identity of this team when we're fully healthy? And is there a game from this season that you can recall that really showcased who we really are at full strength? Because I might go back and watch it if you got something. I need a little pick-me-up. All right, thanks, Bob. Loving the show.
Brett, thank you for the question. And while it's sad hearing you a bit down, needing a pick-me-up, I can certainly relate. Emotionally, I think we're all there with you. I want to address the question in two phases, though. First, with the negative, so that I can end on a positive note. There's a ton of truth to what you're saying. Emotionally, analytically, aesthetically, I don't think there's any Cavs fan that would say, when at full strength, it's been a seamless watch. Everybody expected the Cavaliers to take that core four, nearly a plus nine, in almost 900 minutes last year, and improve upon it because they added pieces to the roster that, in theory, would complement the skills of that core four and lift them up to even higher heights. And even now, knowing what you know about those other guys, Okoro having his best three-point shooting season, Dean Wade having his best three-point shooting season, career nights from Nyang against the Bucks, from Dean Wade against the Celtics, from Max Strus against the Bulls. If I told you all those things, you would just assume, well, holy shit, this is going as well as humanly possible. On paper, we are deep and versatile. And yet, what good is the added depth if the core four cannot stay on the court together? This year, when they have been on the court together, the results have been less inspiring. Their efficiency has dropped. A plus four is the least of our concerns. Yes, they were a plus nine last year. They're a plus four this season. The troubling number is 305 minutes played together. 305 minutes of shared court time in 69 games. We are basically done with the regular season. Now, numbers are great, but context is even more relevant here because you might be saying to yourself, well, I mean, is 305 bad? I don't know what that means. That's just a number. Let me put this in context for you. Do you remember when the New York Knicks, another Eastern Conference title hopeful who's been riddled with injuries, riddled? Do you remember when they acquired OG Anunoby? It was the end of the calendar year. OG Anunoby has been on their roster since roughly January 1st. Their core four, if you want to call their core four, Jalen, Julius, OG, and Dante DiVincenzo, if you want to call that their core four, and I realize some people would argue it's Hartenstein, not Dante, but for the sake of this example, those four together, Jalen, Julius, OG, Dante, they have logged 230 minutes. They're just 70 shy of the amount of minutes that our core four has played together over the course of an entire season. That is sickening They essentially logged 70 less minutes than our entire core four in 1 month together because OG got hurt at the end of January. He's just now coming back. Julius was gone on the 27th of January and hasn't come back since. In 1 month of basketball, they played nearly as much as our entire core four has strung together for the whole season. And I picked them intentionally because that team has also been devastated by injuries. Look at the other Eastern Conference contenders. I don't even want to limit Boston to a core four. I'll give you their entire starting lineup. Tatum, Holiday, White, Jaylen Brown, and Kristaps Porzingis. They've logged 550 minutes together. Now, if you take Kristaps Porzingis, probably the most injury-prone of that group out, the other four guys in the starting lineup have tripled up the Cavs. They're at nearly 900 minutes. Milwaukee, half of their starting lineup is 1,000 years old. And that core four of Giannis, Lillard, Chris Middleton, and Brooke Lopez, they're pushing 600 minutes. Us, the sub-30, the young core, together, we can't stay on the court. For fuck's sake, Tristan Thompson is responsible for taking Donovan Mitchell out of the lineup. Now, this isn't meant to play victim. Everybody deals with injuries. It does kind of feel like at some point, though, when is it going to stop with us? We've had it most. You know the longest run of games the Cavaliers core four have stayed in the lineup together? 7 this season. They've done it for 7 games in a row. We have never got more than a week and a half to 2 weeks of Cavalier basketball before the next bump in the road. And that, to me, is the tragedy of this. When our postseason run comes to an end, some heavy decisions will have to be considered, depending on what happens with Donovan Mitchell and what happens with our extension talks with Isaac Okoro and our early extension talks with Evan Mobley. And it sucks to know that you have to make multiple $100 million-plus contract decisions based off a sample of 305 minutes. Now, take that Knicks group that I told you played roughly 230-something minutes together. In that amount of time, they're a plus 20. Do we think that that core four of the Knicks would sustain that? Probably not, because that's ridiculously effective lineups. But it speaks to the difficulty when the sample size is so small. Do you feel confident that this core four will not work together? Now, I know there's people who are completely comfortable coming to a much quicker conclusion. They're more impulsive. They're more decisive. I've always been that type of person who, when I buy something, I make a major purchase or a decision. I read reviews, scour through consumer reports and all these other things to make sure that I feel confident before I undertake a path that I can't easily escape. I will be okay if we arrive at a point, despite how much I love the theoretical too big construction, if we come to the conclusion that we need to break them up based on evidence, it will be a lot harder to accept that without the kind of closure that comes from having a large body of evidence to draw conclusions from. Let me give you a real life parallel here. Let's say that there's a beloved Cavalier podcaster, part of a two-man duo who's been in your life for 6 to 7 years. And then just one day, poof, gone, just seemingly vanishes off the face of the earth. Doesn't show up at work, doesn't come home. Oh, maybe we should try find your phone. We can't. He has an Android. Now, some people, non-sentimental, non-emotional, they would come to terms with it quickly. In fact, they might embrace it. They might have been sane for ages. We've peaked. With him, it's time to move forward without him. But there will be others, riddled with sorrow, with sadness, with regrets, primarily because they were robbed of closure. What happened? What if some jealous, small-time, half-rate podcaster chartered a boat with money that was supposed to be invested in his child's future college fund? And he went out to sea with a duffel bag approximately the size of a dismembered human body. But its contents are unknown, just speculating, and heaved it over the side. There would be a lot of questions asked, I think, or at least short term there would be. And eventually there'd be a theoretical debate if a Canadian life counts the same as an American life. And then we'd eventually move forward. But my point is that I want the gruesome details. If we are doomed to fail with this core four, I hope we do it on a national stage at full health in the playoffs. Because nothing will leave me feeling as raw as going into the playoffs and wondering what could have been. After a season in which our starting lineup has been together for 19 fucking games. Now, this is the point, Brett, where I will swing this positive as I can, anyway. In that span, they're 13-6. They've won 68% of their games. That's better than this Cavalier team is doing as a whole. It may not feel like it, but if ultimately the goal is to win, they have taken a step forward in that capacity. Now, that's obviously shaded by how much more latitude we have with the upgrade of talent around them. But still, this is a results-oriented business. I think that's relevant to point out. I also think you need to look at the stretches they played together. Now, essentially, this Cavaliers starting lineup has had three runs of health, broken up by a lot of injury time. Jared Allen missed the first five games. And then when he returned, the Cavaliers went 2-3 over that first five-game sample before the first injuries happened. Then they got together between games 16 and 21, and they went 4-2. Progress, right? Then between games 45 and 53, they played seven of those eight games together and went 7-1. Now, it doesn't feel like that to me, Brett. But I would say if we were assigning blame for why we feel let down by the core four this season, 75-80% of the reason is lack of availability. And then the other 20-25% is based on performance. Now, as to what games I found most enjoyable, I would say this. If we want to go early in the season, I thought the back-to-back wins against the Warriors were important. That was when Allen was still kind of finding his footing, and the Cavaliers controlled both of those games fairly handily for a team which usually gives us trouble. And one of those wins came during a West Coast road swing where they were in Sacramento, they were in San Francisco, they were in LA. So I liked those. Then after that injury stretch where Mobley and Garland missed tons of time, there was multiple satisfying games in February. But the three that really stand out to me, maybe four, would be the Spurs game, mainly for Evan Mobley. But the two big construction was huge in that. Mobley and Allen combined for 54 and 26. And Donovan Mitchell had a 30-point game. Garland was the only one who had a muted performance in that Spurs game. But for the people who have questioned the two big construction, that game certainly gives you hope because they both showed out against a guy who's going to be a generational big. And I thought both of our players outplayed him over the course of that game. The Sacramento game that immediately followed that was huge. People forget that while, yes, the bench scored 44 points, I believe, in that game, this was a Kings team who just did us under with three-pointers earlier in the season. And they had come into that first matchup stone cold, and they lit us up with Keegan Murray and Big Red. So for us to come back in that next game and have a much better performance, and it was a ton of balance. There were seven guys in double digits, and we got good contributions across the board. There was four guys with five assists or more. It was a very balanced team outing. Evan Mobley flirted with a triple-double. Jared Allen was close to a 20-10. I think he finished with 19-7 in that game. But point being, those two games are probably the ones in the most recent stretch after everybody came back from the December-January injuries I would look to. The Raptors game was very satisfying. And the Bulls game was satisfying just for the wrong reasons. Everybody was healthy, but that was the Max Strus game. So I wouldn't watch that for faith in our core four. But the big ones for me would probably be the Spurs, the Kings, and both Warriors games. And I know that's really, when I say that out loud, it's really not that awe-inspiring. But it's what we got. We only got a 19-game sample to work from. So one thing, here's a stat that's, I guess, positive, if you want to take it that way. The margin of victory for the Cavs with the core four intact in those 19 games is just shy of 6 points. That's better than their average margin of victory over the course of the season, closer to 4 points. So I know that doesn't necessarily make anyone feel better, but let's move on. Brett, I hope that answered your question. Let's move on to a second submission in the audio mailbag. I've been gone for a week. This is what happens.
Hey, Bob. Isaac from Portland, Oregon. Love the pod. Favorite pod in all of Spotify. Keep it up.
Isaac, look at the Pacific Northwest representing. We've got Alabama locked down with Jeff. Now Seattle, Portland. What do you got, Isaac?
One, Isaac Okoro is incredible. He is, I think, a $12 to $15 million a year player. And I hope he gets that, and I hope we give it to him. He has developed exceptionally well. He's one of the best point of attack defenders in the entire league, if not the best. But I have a question about Evan Mobley. Do you think that he is really worth a rookie max extension? I'm not entirely sure he is, based simply on eye test. I don't have stats to back any of this up, and I know he has lots of potential and he's got lots of upside, but can you write a check for that much money for a player who kind of has to get spoon-fed all of his points? I'm not sure we want to give him that much money until we see some more out of him. What do you think?
Isaac, I think if you had had that opinion a year ago, you would have been attacked by assholes on the internet. Maybe even by me. Who knows? I think a lot of people probably, whether they admit it or not, are questioning that. To be clear, you submitted your audio mailbag prior to my last podcast where we discussed that very subject. I discussed it with the Pelican Substack writer, Shamit Dua, and he brought up Jaren Jackson Jr. as a comp, a guy who didn't get a full max. He got roughly $25 million per year. Anchor of the defense, not the first option offensively, sometimes frustratingly so. And Evan Mobley is kind of in a similar situation here. If you look at his role on our team, do I think that that warrants a max? No, not really, but I think he absolutely will get a max. And what I mean by that is contract negotiations with Evan aren't closed negotiations. It's not just what do we want, what does he want. There's a third party we have to worry about, every other team, and what are they willing to force us to have to do. Do I think in another environment, lacking a dominant big, would a team throw a full max at him because they want to see what he can do as the anchor big who gets heavy usage? I absolutely do. And in that environment, we have no choice but to match. So I think you can say to Evan, if you are willing to risk upsetting him, we don't think you warrant a full max yet. But I think if you decide to go that route, you better know that it very well could end up in a sign and trade, because I think his agent knows that it doesn't matter what we think if there's one other team in the league who does think that. So I would brace yourself for a max, because barring a harsh regression or a severe injury, how high his floor is on the defensive end of the floor, I think will make teams a lot more likely to be willing to risk a max in hopes that it's our team that's suppressing his offensive development and not vice versa. So Isaac, thank you for the submission. Hopefully that clarifies kind of where I stand on it. And anybody who would like to submit their own question or comment, you can do so at CavsPod.com. There is a button that says Talk to Bob. You click it, you record a message. Next thing you know, it's on the podcast. So thank you for listening. Thank you for all of you who have left 5-star rating and reviews. That will do it for this episode of the Fear the Fro podcast. We will be back again. Thank you.
Okay, that's enough.
Stop it!
This has been another
Fear the Fro.
It's over.
Podcast.
That was pathetic.
If you enjoyed what you heard today,
put it on the highlight reel.
Please consider subscribing.
Check out FroPod.com for more Cavaliers and NBA coverage.
That's what's on display here.